This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to Richard Heinberg of the Post-Carbon Institute as he interviews Lester Brown. Lester has a new book out called Plan B 4.0. In this clip, Brown outlines the many positive developments for renewable energy around the world.
What about other renewable energy sources like tidal, geothermal, biofuels, and so on?
In the United States, we now have something like 140 geothermal power plants under construction or in the development stage. And that's going to lead to some very substantial growth. They're almost all in the western U.S. states led by Nevada, Idaho, Utah, California. So we're seeing growth there. We're also seeing a lot of interest in solar thermal. Solar cells have been growing at a pretty good clip, but solar thermal has attracted a lot of recent interest. And it's partly because of the so-called molten salt technology that enables these power plants to use excess heat during the day to melt salt, literally melt the salt, convert it into a liquid stage. Since by nature salt is crystalline, after the sun goes down, the molten salt will revert back to a crystalline form, but it gives off energy in the process. It's about 97% efficient. That is 97% of the energy you invest in melting salt you can take out as heat. That really addresses one of the major problems with solar energy, which is what do you do after the sun goes down? And this technology will provide another 6 hours of generating capacity to take it to midnight or so.
As you say, this is very promising technology, particularly for the American Southwest. How about sort of colder regions like the American Northeast? What are folks up there, what can they look to in terms of renewable energy for things like home heating and electricity generation?
Well, we're seeing pretty rapid growth in the northeastern U.S. In fact, just within the last week or so, the 11 governors of the northeastern states met to devise a common strategy for developing offshore wind resources. Much of our wind is offshore, but because the East Coast is rather shallow, it's fairly easy to develop it. So we're beginning to see momentum building now, with states from Maine to Maryland wanting to develop very substantial offshore wind operations.
It's such an important resource that you're providing for the world right now. We desperately need a Plan B, and your book is the resource. It's the place to go. So thank you so much for doing this work, Lester.
My pleasure. Things are beginning to happen pretty fast now. That's the good news.
That was Richard Heinberg with Lester Brown. Get more info at postcarbon.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are returning to Kurt Cobb, the freelance writer who asks the right questions. Kurt, we've talked a bit about the economy and peak oil. I'd like to move into climate change, where you've kicked a couple of sacred cows, including the dream of a transition to alternative energy. In 2008, you wrote, "That might not work out." Why do you say that?
Well, it's not that I'm against alternative energy. I think we need as much of it as we can possibly get. I think the thing that we need to do in conjunction with that is vastly reduce our energy use. And here's the reason. We have scale problems, and we have what I would call the rate of conversion problem. And I didn't make that phrase up. That was a phrase that David Goodstein, who's vice provost at Caltech, invented. But I think it's a very good way of describing the challenge that faces us. So what do I mean by scale problems? Well, it takes a lot more wind power, a lot more windmills that cover a lot more land area to give us the same power that a coal-fired power plant will give us. And the numbers are just staggering. I mean, you can take like a 500-megawatt power plant, coal-fired power plant, and maybe it sits on 30 acres. And as bad as coal is, as dirty as it is, it's very compact compared to all of the places that it services, all of the buildings that it services. Now let's take wind turbines. For a 500-megawatt power station, to get the equivalent in wind power And now I'm thinking about 5-megawatt turbines, which are the kinds they put out on the ocean, not on the land. But let's say we put them on land. Well, you'd need 233 of them. And if you spaced them properly, all in a line, they'd reach 110 miles. Now, of course, you wouldn't put them in a line like that. You would put them on a wind farm and space them out appropriately. But they take up a lot of space. So that's one problem. They also run at only about 30% of capacity. Now, that means we need a lot more of those than we would need of coal-fired power plants. So we can just turn on and off at will. You know, we don't have to worry about the wind. So that's one problem. And this problem is true for solar. It's true for biofuels. It's the scale problem. To scale these things up is an enormous task. And there are, of course, the problems of being intermittent. You know, the sun doesn't always shine. It doesn't shine at night. The wind doesn't always blow. So to me, the second thing that we need to do is to bring down our energy use enormously, which we can do. We have the capability of doing that. The passive house, this is a house without a furnace, mind you, brings energy down 80%. You say, well, how is that possible? Well, if you build in enough insulation, and if you use passive solar techniques, you can have a warm house in a northern climate with no furnace. That's a huge reduction. Now, if we get reductions like that in transportation, how would we do that? Well, the quickest way to do that would be to share rides, and there are ride-sharing services that are now cropping up around the world. People are a little leery of that because who am I going to ride with? Well, they're trying to work that out. You know, maybe you're a woman. You don't want to ride with men. You'll only ride with women. They're trying to check the people out who will offer the rides. It's not a perfect system, but we could very quickly bring down energy usage. If we do that, then I think we have a possibility of having a society that's run using these alternatives. But there's one other problem, and you already mentioned it, and that is this rate of conversion problem. How much time do we have to do that? Because in order to do that, we're going to need to use current energy from mostly fossil fuels to create this new alternative energy society. Well, if our current energy sources are declining, and it's not clear yet about oil or natural gas or even coal, if they're declining now, when they will decline. But if we wait, and let's say we reach a peak in oil in, say, 2015, and that's the time when we decide, well, now we're going to really make a push for alternative energy. We're going to find our whole society has less and less energy each year. And people are going to say, well, gee, you know, the first thing I need to do is take care of my needs right now. I don't want to have, you know, 25% of my income go toward paying for alternative energy through increased utility rates and taxes and subsidies. I want right now that energy to live, to go to work, to buy my food, and so forth. And so you have this, you're going to have this competition as energy supplies decline between trying to create the new alternative energy society and just trying to meet people's current needs. And I think, you know, we're very close to a situation where that might happen. And I'm not sure we have, you know, the 20 years or 30 years or so we need to make that transition smoothly. I think it's going to be a rough transition if it's made at all, and there's going to be a lot of difficulty getting people to say, yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, who's going to, in a declining economy, in a declining energy economy, going to say, well, gee, I'm going to shell out, you know, several thousand dollars for solar water heating or solar photovoltaic and so forth? They aren't going to have those resources. They're going to be crimped. And so this is, I think, our biggest concern.
So if I get it right, just as we personally may say, well, I'd love to have solar, but I'm too broke to buy the panels, the whole government and society itself could enter into that if we wait too long.
In some ways, I think we're there. I mean, if you look at the developed countries, the so-called developed countries, the rich countries, they're all terribly in debt. The United States, not Canada, they've been very cautious. A lot of the European countries now, we're seeing Greece has overspent, and they don't have the resources that would be necessary, I think, to move into this alternate energy economy. So we may already be there, and this is a real concern. Now, the kinds of resources that would be necessary to make this change are are currently available. I think it's we're still able to do that, but where are they going? You know, where are those resources going? They're going toward things like, in the United States, with this huge stimulus package, repairing our current road system. Well, that's not going to help us get to where we need to go. They're going to military expenditures. Well, those military expenditures are primarily in the United States for protecting, essentially protecting oil, sources of oil abroad. That's not going to help us. A lot of that money is just not going in the right place. And I think we're going to have year after year after year of that because the people who are at the top, the people who are running the country, don't recognize that we need to get on the fast track for this.
I guess there are a few people in the Obama administration who want to get that conversion going, but they felt hampered by Congress or by their bankers. I don't know. I think that's a little too deep for us to go into right here today. But I did want to bring up this thing that some big names like Dr. James Hansen and Bill Gates, they say nuclear is the way to go. And it upsets me when people, including President Obama recently, say that nuclear power doesn't have any carbon emissions. Of course it does in the various stages of construction and fuel rods and maintenance of the waste afterwards. What's your take on the nuclear option?
I'm not knee-jerk opposed to the use of nuclear power, but I think a short history lesson is in order, and that is, in the United States, I can speak to mostly the United States here, we had a government, you know, a public-private partnership, and it was a government-driven initiative to bring nuclear power to civilian use. Now, one of the things that the government wanted to do was make sure that the nuclear industry in America had dual use. That is, they could always go to it for what they needed for military purposes. Now, what was the result of this? The result was that we focused on uranium-filled reactors. And so that's what we have today. That's the technology we've developed. And to me, I don't have to list all the problems for you and probably for the people who are listening to this. It's just an enormous mess. And it's a very complex, difficult system to maintain and to grow. I'd be very surprised if in the United States we go beyond simply replacing the reactors that we currently have to shut down. I don't think there's going to be any growth. Now, we could have chosen an alternative route. What was that alternative route? Back in the 60s, the people at Oak Ridge, this was one of the government laboratories, developed what's called the molten salt reactor. It runs at a lot lower temperature. It uses thorium, which is much more abundant. It creates new fuel. It's a breeder. It can create new fuel as it works. And it recycles almost all of the waste while it's creating power. So I'm not saying this is an ideal solution, but it has a lot less waste. It's not going to melt down. We know how to do it. Why didn't we choose it? Because it doesn't have military applications that we decided we needed to build into our civilian nuclear program. That opportunity has been lost, in my view, and it's this rate of conversion problem. How quickly could we convert to nuclear power if we wanted to power more and more of our society and maybe virtually all of it on nuclear power? The answer is not very quickly. Nuclear facilities, their life cycle, their startup is measured in decades. Well, we don't have decades. So although I think there are nuclear technologies that would work, I don't think we're going to use them. I don't think we have time to use them.
Meanwhile, the Saudis are using more of their own oil. They want to convert their own economies, and we have other countries in the Middle East want to build their nuclear plants. And more oil is going to China and India, of course, as they try and adopt our lifestyle. So I want to ask, as a backup, could we ramp up coal production and coal gasification to buy a few decades while we figure out these other options?
Well, it seems to me that we're probably going to do some of that because America has very, very large coal reserves. But one of the things we need to be concerned about is that once we decide to go down that road, whether we do it with natural gas, now that there is the feeling that we have lots of natural gas and the shale gas reserves under the United States, that we are going to end up exponentially increasing our consumption of coal or natural gas, as I mentioned. Well, if we do that, then the time to exhaustion is going to reduce considerably. The time to peak is going to come in much closer. So I think what we'd be faced with if we go to a coal economy, and I'm not putting that out of the realm of possibility, I think we will start to do very desperate things when our imports of oil start to decline, which, you know, you're mentioning what is really called the net export crisis. People who are producing oil are going to use more and more of it. They're going to decide they want to export less and less of it, and we, who are the large importing nations, are going to find out that there's less available, it's going to be much more expensive, and we're going to need to find alternatives. Okay, so we go to coal, we ramp up production, and we decide to make some of it into liquid fuels. But if we're growing coal consumption at, let's say we grow it at 7% a year, that's a big leap, but you know, we might have to do something like that. Well, that means that every 10 years, we would be doubling our coal production. Well, you do that a few times and you're out of coal. So I think that it's not even really a temporary stopgap, because what happens is you get to the peak that you're able to in coal production if you do this, or in natural gas production if you're using natural gas for your whole economy. And then what do? You're back to where you are with peak oil. You've got peak coal, peak natural gas, and you have to find some sustainable long-term energy source. Why don't we take all the money that we would have put into that and put it into creating the alternative energy society, the sustainable energy society that we know is possible, wind and solar, to a certain extent biofuels. I'm not a big biofuels fan. We could talk about that later. But instead, it seems to me that we're going to go down this dead end, this maybe coal-fired end or natural gas-fired economy, and it's just ruinous and foolish.
Kurt Cobb, can you tell us a bit more about David Goodstein, where he comes from, and why his work has been important?
David Goodstein is at Caltech. He's a physicist. He was the vice provost. I'm not sure that he's still a vice provost there. But he wrote a small book called Out of Gas back in 2004. It was about peak oil, and he discussed it from a physicist's point of view. And so it was useful in understanding how things actually get done in society. What we do is we burn fossil fuels, and it creates more entropy, and we use the entropy that's created, essentially the heat that's created, to get a little bit of work done, to move something from here to there, whether it's electrons or, you know, big shovels of ore. So it's a nice way to understand how energy actually runs through our economy and how it does work. Now, one of the things he said in this book was that he was very concerned about the rate of conversion problem. That's the first place I've ever seen that phrase. So that has become a sort of central organizing principle in my mind. The rate at which we do things, the rate at which we're consuming oil, natural gas, coal, the rate at which we're spewing carbon dioxide into the air, these rates are very, very important because they determine how we're going to live. We are not going to run out of oil tomorrow or in the next 10 years or in the next 100 years, but the rate at which we can produce oil is inevitably going to decline. And that's our whole infrastructure is designed around a certain rate of production of fossil fuels. If we need to make a transition, then there's a certain rate at which we're going to need to make that transition to prevent us from running into trouble. Now, it's Goodstein's view that we're past that point. We're not going to make a smooth transition if we make any transition at all. And I encourage people to think in terms of rates, because so often we will hear, well, there's plenty of coal, there's plenty of natural gas, there's huge amounts of oil. And you know, there really are large amounts of fossil fuels lying around, and a lot of them we're going to be able to get out of the ground. The key question is, at what rate? And I think that's the problem that we're going to be having from here on out.
I want to ask you about another article you wrote in 2009. It's called No Second Chance. In it, you talk about the problems with the way economists look at the world. Can you tell us what is biophysical economics?
Well, biophysical economics is an emerging field. It's I don't know if it's quite a separate field from ecological economics, but its focus is on energy and how energy runs through the economy and what the implications of that energy loop are for our economic lives. Why is traditional economics a problem? Well, basically the kind of economics which are practiced now. And look, these economists run policy in every major country in the world. They control economic thinking in our universities. They're working out of a framework that says the economy just pulls whatever it needs from the natural world, and market forces govern what we'll pull, and if we run out of something, we'll substitute something else that's available from the natural world. And so we'll never run out of what we need. We'll just change what we use to do what we need to get done. Now, that works out when you have an increasing supply of what you need, an increasing supply of oil, an increasing supply of copper, and you have the necessary technology to continue to mine ever and ever leaner ores and to drill for and extract ever and ever more difficult pockets of oil. Now the question is technology going to win the race with depletion for a lot of essential minerals? I think that already in the area of oil, technology is losing and has been for 3 or 4 decades. We're not replacing the oil that we consume. I think we're going to soon find that in some metals.
Now, we've been talking about coal and oil depletion without really mentioning too much the possibility that the climate will be distorted so badly that people will demand a change or will have to walk away from it, or that our systems will be wrecked by weird weather or even our agricultural systems. What is your take on recent climate science? Is it time to panic?
Yeah, today's a good day to panic. I say that because James Hansen, who's, I think, regarded as the premier climate scientist in the world, has said we need to be below 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Well, we're above that. So if we're going to get back down below that, we're going to have to do some serious retooling of the entire of, you know, all of human civilization. And we have to do it fast. So here, on the one hand, I'm talking about available resources and depletion and burning more coal and so forth. Well, that may not be a good option for us, even if we can do it, because we're already beyond what a lot of scientists regard as an important tipping point in greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. So what does that imply? We'd have to put together a political consensus that that reduction needs to take place and fast, and Copenhagen was a disaster. Not unexpected, in my view, because with the world in economic crisis, who wants to pay for reductions in carbon dioxide? And the thing that really ought to concern people is that the effects of putting more and more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere may not be linear. That is, we've been having this sort of gradual march up in temperature, a gradual melting in the poles, and suddenly now the melting's increased enormously. In the last 10 years, we've had a nonlinear effect, and I think we're going to see more of those nonlinear effects. I don't have a good answer for this.
Well, neither do I, and I find this whole subject about our future really almost impossible to cover. I mean, the bugs in British soil have skyrocketed, and Antarctic icebergs break off in the wrong places, and we get wild, weird weather, and I'm racing to try to learn about all these things. What are some of the strategies that you use to cope with a tsunami of information?
My focus has been primarily on resources and, to a certain extent, climate. And I've found good sources where I write. Energy Bulletin and Oil Drum, I think, are excellent sources. And they sound like they're all just about, you know, fossil fuels and but actually, they're quite wide-ranging in their coverage of these issues. They offer a conceptual framework that I think is useful. That is, they think in terms of complex systems. This, I think, is the central difficulty, intellectual difficulty of our age. And that is, we live in complex systems, but we don't understand complexity. Now, how can you start to understand that complexity? Well, you have to read about it. You have to explore it. You have to think about it because it's not immediately obvious. When I come home and I turn on the light switch, I don't have to know a thing about how power plants work. I don't have to know where the fuel source comes from. I don't know half know anything about electrical lines, all I have to do is flick the switch. Same thing for my furnace. When I get in my car, all I have to do is turn the key and the thing turns on. I don't have to know anything about how cars are made. I don't have to know any of that stuff in order for me to get through my daily life. And that is part of the problem, is I don't have to. And most people don't have to. But for those who want to know, I think there's just a lot of good information on the Internet. The two places I mentioned are good places to start. For climate, whenever I want to catch up on what's happening in the world of climate change, I go to realclimate.com. It's the blog site where a lot of the professional climate scientists post, and I find it useful when I read something in the news, you know, this has happened. For example, there was a report about methane being released from the Arctic Ocean. And I thought, well, this has got to be really bad. So I go to Climate, Real Climate, and they have a nice piece on it, and they say, look, it's bad, and it's important for us to watch this, but we've already got something that's really bad, which is man-made CO2 emissions, and we need to really get focused on those. So it was a nice corrective. I'm not saying I'm any less concerned about climate change as a result of that, but at least my understanding of those two systems is enhanced. Those are places that I go every day. Now, you know, there's all kinds of stuff all over the Internet, but that's my main diet.
And I would just add perhaps climateprogress.org, Joe Rome's blog. I find that very helpful. Well, one of the strange things, despite the dark problems that we're wrestling with, is that I really enjoy my life. I talk with interesting people all over the world about the biggest issues of our times, maybe of any times. And I'm thinking, if you and I really give up, we won't be writing or making radio anymore. I think that's when people should give up hope, when activists and independent researchers just go quiet and move to undisclosed locations to spend their last days, maybe. You're writing a lot, so you must still have some hope about this.
I do think that regardless of what happens, that it's important for us to move from what I'll call a sort of pre-ecological society to a post-ecological society. That is, it would be very helpful if people could see things as interconnected and understand that you can't just do one thing. Whenever you do one thing, you affect something else. This is going to be important no matter what happens. If we make it through this energy transition, if we successfully address climate change, we're going to do that only if we can understand complex systems like the biosphere and begin to interact with them in more respectful and positive ways. So I don't imagine that I am personally going to save the world. It's a big job, and it's going to take a lot of people. But what I know I can do is help people understand these difficult concepts and try to enunciate those concepts in language that they can understand, that they can then communicate to their friends and their coworkers and their family. So I've sort of carved out that niche. Other people are taking different tacks, but I think that information is going to be useful no matter where we go, whether everything turns out badly or we move into a wonderful new world of alternative energy and sustainable agriculture and green cities.
I agree, and I think that's to some degree what I'm trying to do as well. So I guess I would wrap up by saying for our listeners, watch out if the independent voices go quiet. Meanwhile, our guest has been Kurt Cobb. Find his work at resourceinsights.blogspot.com and all over the net wherever energy and environment are spoken. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Kurt.
I'm glad to do it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.